Woohoo! I had to point out to some young people in Australia that as far as I knew, yo was not a word in the English dictionary. Unless yo is also after it, when it becomes yo-yo. That is still a word, yo. Ruth chapter 1. We are now at verse 6, and we're moving forward to the end. Look at the situation that Naomi has on her hands. Her husband is dead. Her two sons are dead. Look at the situation she had on her hands before they died. What did she have? She's living in isolation. She's living away from the ecclesia. She's watching the spiritual weakness in her husband and in her children. And it just is terribly depressing for her at this point in time. Then they marry outside of the truth. And this was a bad situation. What could she do? She made the best of it. She was determined to teach these girls the truth. Now, doubtless, she must have had a warm and loving interaction with these girls. And I want you to bear something else in mind about marriage, young people. Take a good look at the parents of the girl that you're going to marry, because it's a package deal. If you cannot stand her mum, or you cannot get along with his dad, that's who you're going to have to interact with for the next 30 years. And it could pose a problem in the long term. So if you find that kind of a challenge and a difficulty, bear that in mind. You're not just marrying this one unit and there's some sort of a fence that's around her and you away from the family. So families have to get along with families, and you have to be able to realize, I now have to honor this other mom and dad like they're a mom and dad to me too. And so these are things to bear in mind, right? Now there's all kinds of variations and unique circumstances. You may have a young woman who is just a wonderful sister, lovely girl, and you think she is just wonderful. She may have a father who's an alcoholic and a mother who's in the truth but struggling. Do you not marry her as a consequence? No, you do, but you just understand. You now are going to have to deal with some realities of the continuation of family life that will pose challenges. At some point in time, you're going to have children. Lord willing. When the children come along, you're going to have to make the decision, well, mom and dad want to have them come spend the weekend with them. And you know your father-in-law is not always the best influence around your children. And you know your mother-in-law may or may not get them out to the meeting on the Sunday morning. So these are things you'll have to think through, you'll have to work through, you'll have to find ways to cope through and contend with. These are all the little complexities of life that people don't tell you about or that you don't know. There's not a book that you open up that says, I'm 12. How many of you are 12? Going on 13. Put your hand up. You can't wait to be 13 because when you're 13, boom, you turn into an adult. We all experienced it. That's what happened. We went to sleep and we were 4'2" tall. We woke up, we were 6'4" tall the next morning because we turned 13, right? And you keep reminding your parents, I'm going to be 13. Don't forget, you people who don't know anything. I'm going to be 13. As if something happens, this threshold of 13 that hits you and you suddenly turned into a new person. Well, as it turns out, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, and 19 have their challenges. And 19 is very different to 13. So you may think at 13 you've arrived at the teen club. And your 19-year-old brother still looks at you like you're some kind of skunk every time you come into his room. Right? So just bear that in mind. If there was a book that you could buy when you were little, that your mom and dad could give you that says, when you become a teenager, Here are the problems you're going to have to deal with. We wouldn't be in such a rush to become teenagers. If somebody could then point you to the chapter on getting married and was to then lay out married life over a 10, 15, 20, 30, 40, 50, 60, 70 year cycle, and you saw, like the graph of a stock or a mutual fund, what married life is all about, you know, you would not rush into marriage. If somebody were then to turn to the chapter that said, and having children, what's it like to raise a baby to the teenage years? And then through to the other side of the tunnel. We wouldn't rush into having babies. But it's as if God has designed into the whole situation these little pockets of ignorance that keep the race going, you know, and that continues somehow in the end to produce believers through it all and in spite of it all, right? That's the way it works. Well, Naomi must have imagined growing up, raising her babies. These boys are going to marry two lovely girls in Bethlehem, Judah. I'll have grandchildren. It's going to be great. Then she's in isolation. Then the husband dies. Then the boys marry Moabite girls, and there's no children. Now, she could have been the bitterest woman on the face of the earth. But she learned what a wise Christadelphian sister learns. Don't work in your mind with what you wish you had. Work with what you've got and make the best of it. That's what she did. Did she love these girls? Or did she continually cock an eyebrow every time they walked into the room as if to say, you again, the daughter-in-law I never wanted. And you, the other daughter-in-law I never wanted. Well, I suppose I have to put up with you because I have no choice. None of that. She loved them. She loved them enough that when they had to part, all three of them lifted their voices in weeping. And it says here that at some point in time after the boys die, her sons, and that word, sons, is very expressive. It's a word that implies children. In fact, the Revised Version says children. And some have even interpreted the word babies into it. But it doesn't make sense. But to Naomi, as a mother, they were always her babies. Remember, your mother has a connection to you that your father doesn't. Your mother had you inside of her body for 9 months, carried you, went through the pain of giving birth to you. There's an intense connection in your mother's heart and feelings to you that your father doesn't have, as much as he may love you. And fathers can't sometimes comprehend that. Sometimes women have almost a sixth sense about what's going on in their child's mind, and they know something's wrong. Father looks at it from the outside and says, nothing looks wrong, nothing's broken, and he's not bleeding. He seems to be all right to me. He's talking intelligibly. I can understand what he's saying. Mother says, no, something's wrong. She can feel it because you're her baby. I know you don't want to hear. I know you're an 18-year-old, full-grown man and everything. I know that. I don't doubt that you're a full-grown man, mature in your years. You've walked on the earth 18 full long years and have the wisdom that comes with that accomplishment. But she still sees you as her baby. She remembers you as a baby. When these boys died, her babies had died. And there's something that breaks forever in the heart of a parent when they have to bury their children. Because that's not the way it should be. So these two boys die. And it says she arose with her daughters-in-law that she might return from the country of Moab. That word return is used many times through this chapter. If you were to just sort of little pencil mark all the way through. Verse 6. Then she arose with her daughters-in-law that she might return from the country of Moab. Next, verse 7, they went on the way to return unto the land of Judah. Verse 8, Naomi said unto her two daughters-in-law, go, return each of you to her mother's house. Verse 10, they said unto her, surely we will return with thee unto thy people. And Naomi said, turn again. It's the same word, return, my daughters. Why will you go with me? Verse 12, turn again, same word. Then, verse 15, behold, thy sister-in-law is gone back. It's the same word, return, unto her people and unto her gods. Return, thou after thy sister-in-law. Right? Ruth said, entreat me not to leave thee, to return from following. That's number 9. Number 10, verse 21. I went out full, and the Lord hath brought me home, or returned me home. Verse 22, number 11. So Naomi returned. And then finally, Ruth the Moabitess, her daughter-in-law, with her, which returned out of the country of Moab. 12 times in 22 verses, God's telling us something. You cannot go so far away from God so that you can't come back if there's breath in your nostrils. Whatever you have done, wherever you have gone, whatever you have committed, whatever sin you have fallen into, you can still come back to God. This is a chapter about God bringing people through the circumstances of their lives back home to stay. Even new people who hadn't known him before. That's what this chapter is about. It's about a God who is very loving and very merciful, very compassionate. It may have looked to Naomi. Naomi could easily have had an Elimelech's attitude. God doesn't care about us. He doesn't do anything. Look, our people are starving in Bethlehem, Judah. Look at these boys, sickly, sickly boy, this boy that's always sad and walking around forlorn, pining away. Right? And look how tough life is. God, don't tell me about God. I don't want to hear anything about God. That could have been her attitude. That was Elimelech's attitude. But God was not absent. The trouble that they were going through was not evidence of the fact that God didn't care and that God was not with them. God was working on Naomi. And through Naomi, God was working on Ruth. Through it all. Now, if Naomi had been bitter, if she had had that sense of being ripped off by God, God didn't care, I'm going to do what I want to do, she would have died like Elimelech. What happens in this situation is, after all these years of being away, she stops and she thinks, you know what? It doesn't matter how prosperous we might have become in Moab. It doesn't matter that the people around here look up to us. I'm going back home to the ecclesia because that's where I need to be. And I've lost everything that was of value to me outside of God. And now I need to go back to Him. She gets up and she's going. And it says the daughters-in-law go with her. Now, it says she was coming back from the country of Moab, for she had heard in the country of Moab the Lord had visited His people in giving them bread. Now, the word visited can be interpreted to mean He had looked after the needs of, He had expressed concern for the people. He had come to see and acted for their good. That's what it can be interpreted to mean, by giving them food. So evidently the people had turned around and they'd come back to God. And Bethlehem, Judah was now a house of bread and praise. And Naomi decides she's going back home. How would she know that? Is it that people kept in contact with her from the ecclesia, or that traveling people coming through would give her what was going on in the way of news? Sometimes we know Christadelphians who have left the ecclesia. But when you meet them, they want to know about everybody. They want to know about uncle this and auntie that. What about this one? What about that one? I heard such and such just got married. They want to know these things. What do? Say, look, you're not in the truth. So don't talk to me about these things. No. We tell them. We want them to know that ecclesia life is happy and that we want them in I want to attract them back. So somebody kept in touch with her, possibly. Or people coming through told her what was going on. And then she decided to go back home. She comes back and it says, verse 7, "Wherefore she went forth out of the place where she was, and her two daughters-in-law with her. And they went on the way to return unto the land of Judah." Now that word way is the, what's the Hebrew word, derek. And it means a way, a road. It can also be interpreted, depending on how it's used in different passages, to be a way of life. What it clearly means is that there was a road that led back to the ecclesia. There was a way back. Don't block the way back for people. Don't act like there's no way back when somebody makes a terrible mistake in the truth or walks away from the truth. Sometimes we can do that. Sometimes we can give them the sense that they've left, the doors are closed forever. They're too bad and evil to come back. And that's not true. Because of being bad and evil with things that should not be in us if we were to be in the truth, how many of us would be in it? Our hearts are wicked. The imagination and the thoughts of our heads are evil at least occasionally, which at least puts us in a situation that is the equivalent of those whose sins have come out on the outside and are publicly known. Right? So let's not think we're better than anyone else. And if you know young people that are struggling in the truth, then do what you can to keep contact and to express affection for them and to make them feel not like they're out there people that you're not going to have anything to do with at all, but have a little lifeline with them if you can, without being influenced in their direction to do wrong. Right? And if there's no way that person wants to hear anything about the truth or about ecclesia life or about coming back, then fine. Let them have that space and that distance. Just work with what you can under the circumstances. Right? And so when we go through the rest of the chapter, it says, "Naomi said unto her two daughters-in-law, Go, return each of you to her mother's house." Right? "And may the Lord deal kindly with the dead." Okay. Do we have three chairs? Ha! There's one. Let's help. We need three chairs. Here's one.
Thank you.
You're welcome. There's a piano stool. Ah, there's another one. Look at me standing beside this brother. Isn't it ridiculous?
When I was, I did wake up 13, 6'4 one day.
There you That's go. True. And we just need a third chair. Do we have enough? Ah, there's another one. Chair number three. Okay, three chairs. See, these things keep you alive and awake. Yeah, third session. Starting to see people move over 45-degree angles onto the shoulder of the person beside you. The signs are there of exhaustion beginning to occur in the group. Good. And be careful, or I'll have you doing some Tai Chi during one of these classes. Okay. So we go on, and he says, and why would she say this? It is evident that she loved them both intensely, right? It's evident. She loves them, right? She says to the daughters-in-law, go back to your mother's houses. Why would she say that? Because she loved them. And then she says, and may the Lord deal kindly with you. So she's keeping the truth alive in them. What she's saying is, hold on to what I taught you. Hold on to the truth about Yahweh, the God of Israel, and what he did with the nation, what he's going to do long in the long run, the coming Redeemer, the great King that's going to come one day. Right? This is a woman who doubtless taught them about a king that was not her husband, the man whose name meant either God is my king, which was a lie in his case, or unto me shall the kingdom come, which was also a foolish and false notion in his own mind. So she says, remember the truth. Hold on to the truth. Now, if she loved them, why would she send them back home? because she didn't want them to do anything in connection with the God of Israel against their will. Because also she knew what life for a Moabite woman would be like back in the land of Bethlehem, Judah. How did Jewish men see Moabite women? What did they know and remember of Moabite women? They remembered Balaam had used the Moabite women to cause Israel to stumble through immorality. They knew that Phinehas had put a spear through a man who was a prince of the congregation and a Moabite woman, right? So what they knew about Moabite women was they were loose. You know, you could do anything you wanted with them. And that theirs was an open society where there was no faithfulness. And therefore, the mindset of a Jewish man was, these girls are indecent, unclean people. And other men would abuse them. And Naomi didn't want to expose those girls to anything like that. So she wants them to go with her, but at the same time she's afraid for them to go with her. And then she takes a step because she sees they're not going to leave unless I tell them to leave. She says to them, they're going along the way back home to Bethlehem, Judah. And she stops and she says, go back home. Go to your mother's houses. And remember the Lord. And then it says, the Lord grant you that you may find rest, each of you, in the house of her husband. Then she kissed them and lifted up their voice, and they wept. So she acknowledges they're young enough to remarry. And she knows that they should. And she sends them back home. But such is the love that they have for this mother-in-law. That's how loving she was with them. That's how much she cared about them as individuals. She saw past whatever racial difference there was between her and them. And that's something you need to bear in mind too, especially in this country where there's this weird, just inconceivable obsession with race. Well, in Canada, we can't comprehend it to the same degree. But that is a weird and crazy aspect of American life. You've got to see past those things as Christadelphians so that you don't see color, background. You see people inside. That's what you're looking for. That's how Naomi saw these girls. She didn't feel prejudice and racism. I'll tell you a couple of funny stories. Like, I've had a very minimal experience of some of these wonderful American issues that in traveling through. Remember once going to a particular state that will remain nameless in a particular year and ecclesia that will be unidentified. And a sister went up to my wife and indicated, and I'm only telling you this because there's a comical side to all of this to make you laugh, so the lesson goes in. And the sister came up and I knew somebody like Dev once. He came around selling vacuum cleaners once at our house. And Rose stood there and thought, well, what does one say next? And the sister felt the same way too. And I think that was the end of the conversation. But it was weird. It was strange. It was out of the ordinary. And there have been times when sisters have come up to my wife and said, well, what's it like being married to somebody like that? And my wife will answer them and say, well, it's no different to being married to anybody else. I mean, doesn't run around screaming in Hindi through the house or unrolling a turban and lassoing the kids with it. Or doesn't throw pieces of curried chicken at me when he doesn't like what I've cooked. So, was there something else you wanted to know? So there are humorous aspects to this, but what it means is this. Because of the nature of society, the background, the civil war, slavery, et cetera, all these things, there's kind of a fearfulness in America of people that look different to the majority. And don't be afraid. There's nothing to be afraid of. We're all people. Christ, God, Paul say in Scripture, there's no longer, through the truth, any distinction between Jew or Gentile. And you could read that with any two races, right? Any two races at all, male or female. We're all one in Christ Jesus, meaning that we are all of equivalent value in God's eyes. So we need to be of equivalent value in each other's eyes. And we don't need to have all these crazy, nutty, you know, stilted conversations about background. Just see past that. Just connect as people. I do not care whatsoever what the racial background is of any of the sons-in-law that my daughters will marry. I don't care about that. What I care about is, do they love the truth? Do they love the ecclesia? Are they boys of good character? Will they take care of my daughter? Everything else is a frill. It doesn't matter if they come from a wealthy home. You know, sometimes people are wanting to marry a boy that's rich. Now, please get that stupid thing out of your head. What's the matter with you? Are you crazy or something? If you think money is going to give you happiness, just look at the people that populate Hollywood. They should have the happiest marriages on the face of the earth because they're the best looking people with the most plastic in their system of anybody on the face of the earth. And they have more money than anybody else. And they should have the happiest marriages. Do they? Right? They don't. They don't. So money and good looks and all of these things, it doesn't matter. Racial background doesn't matter. Naomi saw past all of that to the character of the girls. She worked with who they were. She worked with their thinking. She appealed to them as her daughters. These were girls of a completely different racial background who Jews would have looked down on in every way imaginable. They wouldn't even have touched them. They weren't allowed in the congregation of the Lord up to a certain generation. And Naomi made them her daughters. That's what a Christadelphian needs to be like. All right? So remember that. Doesn't matter if you're black or white or yellow or brown. When you cut past the skin-deep outward appearance and whatever our cultural background is, we're people with the same fears and weaknesses, with the same problems and needs, and we're brothers and sisters to each other. Through Christ, Christ took away all those things that create this division and separation between people and among people, right? It's a funny thing. You think, well, racism is something characteristically here that's between people of different colors. Well, in my social background, my historical background, I come from people that came originally from India. And they were Hindus. And back in India, there's something called the caste system. Within Hinduism, the top, the pinnacle, is the priestly caste. After them would be the royalty, the kings. The beneath the priests. Beneath the royalty is the merchant caste. Beneath the merchant caste is the servant caste. And then underneath is a vast group called the untouchables. If a Brahmin was sitting, who is of the priestly caste, eating his food, and an untouchable walked by, and his shadow touched the food, you had to dig a hole and bury the food and have a cleansing ritual. If you were walking along the street and you were of a higher caste and an untouchable was walking towards you, the untouchable would lie down on the ground so that his shadow somehow would not touch you as you walked by. You looked at these people, and sometimes you couldn't tell the differences between them. But so highly evolved had their racism and prejudice become that they could tell immediately from a phrase, from the way a person held himself or herself, from the way a person would greet you, what their caste was, and immediately shot you into a particular subsection of how you dealt with people, and you'd push them away. You push them away. That's not my castle. I don't have anything to do with those sorts of people. So it's not just about color. Sometimes it's about those sorts of things, where you are in society. Sometimes people that are very well educated look down on people that are laborers with their hands. And they don't have much to do with each other. Right? So we find ways to create division, even when there's nothing that is visually obvious to divide us. It is a human trait. But Christ is a uniter. And he united us through his death and resurrection. And so we need to think past that stuff to feel a sense of strong family and kinship with all people that are in the truth. What would you do if you went to Africa to do some mission work? Would you hold yourself off as, ooh, look, all these black people. This is scary. I don't know what to do. Of course it's not. That would be idiotic. These are your brothers and sisters. What if you were a black brother and you went to Germany and you remembered all the stuff about the Holocaust and the Nazis and this and that, and there you are in the Esslingen Ecclesia and everybody is white except you? Would you sort of hide in the corner and think, I hope nobody shoots me? Right? Because this is Germany and I remember what happened. No, you wouldn't. You just step right out and make yourself a brother among the brothers and sisters. And when you see flicker on somebody's face, the look. Do you know what the look is? Most of you wouldn't know what the look is. But if you have any kind of ethnic background, you know the look. It is a slight hesitation. It is a look and then a relaxation quick because they notice you saw the look. And what it is, I don't know quite how to interact with this sort of person. And then you stretch out past it. Don't get, if you're a person of some kind of background, if you're a woman and you're speaking to a brother who is used to looking at sisters as if they're beneath brethren, you know what the look is, don't you? When you go and you speak to a brother, and it's almost as if he didn't see you were there. You ask a question, he didn't hear what you said. He didn't even answer. Or he answered another question that he wished you'd asked, if you had any sense in your head, being a mere woman and all. Right? You come across these kinds of boneheaded, primitive, masculine, Christadelphian, unevolved attitudes at times, don't you, young sisters and older sisters? You see the look. Now, what do? Do you walk away in bitterness? Do you get angry? Do you suddenly jump into that group of, I am woman, hear me roar? Right? In the brotherhood, you know, the feminist contingent, the ones that are going to revolutionize everything so that those the single-eyebrowed individuals will drop off the edge. And a new generation will be created that will, you know, be the right kind of men. Of course not. Did Christ do that? You stretch past your gender, your ethnicity, your financial situation, the trouble of your life to extend a hand. And when you see a look of whatever, just ignore it and be a person. To that person, you may find that suddenly they change. And if they don't, at least you did the right thing. So being embittered about, you know, this kind of people are like this, and, you know, even in the brotherhood, I see this going on all the time. Yes, you will find people who, because of the limitations of their upbringing, cannot see past their stereotypes and assumptions of women, of people of different backgrounds to themselves, and so on and so forth. And when you meet it, just accept that's the way it is. If you have the opportunity to do something to help it by being frank, fine. But be careful, right? And try as best you can to push past it so that you maintain a degree of dignity and brotherliness and sisterliness in yourself. And always leave the door open for somebody to change how they interact, right? Somebody to come out of their mindset to a better mindset. Because it happens all the time. It really does. So we go on then, move past. She doesn't want to take them back. She's sending them back home. She says, look, I can't even have children. Would you wait for me to raise the children if I could so that you'd marry them? That's illogical. Go back home. And it says, verse 14, they lifted up their voice, they wept again, and Orpah kissed her mother-in-law. But Ruth clave unto her. She said, look, behold, thy sister-in-law has gone back unto her people and unto her gods. You see, she knew Orpah. As much as she loved her, she knew Orpah will not hold on to the truth. She'll go back to what she was raised with. Right? And it may well have been that Orpah was a kind-hearted, loving person. Because she was. Ruth says, you've been kind to those that have died. So that's what these two girls were like. But she knew she wouldn't stay studying the truth. And then Ruth says to her, don't entreat me to leave you and to return from following you. For wherever you're going, I'm going. Wherever you're going to stay, I will stay. Your people will be my people and your God, my God. Where thou diest will I die, and there will I be buried. Now, is that because this was just a young girl who had no clue? She didn't know what they were like back in the land of Bethlehem, Judah. She didn't understand how Jews viewed Moabite people? Of course not. She had a precise understanding of it all. She knew, and she was making a choice. She was choosing to join the people of God in spite of the limitations of the people of God. God's truth is perfect, but God's people aren't. And the first thing you need to get into your heads is the behavior of Christadelphians does not imply that what they believe is wrong. It doesn't. So some people sometimes think, well, if those people really had the truth, they wouldn't behave like that. Israel had the truth. And they behaved inappropriately. Right? Adam and Eve and their children had the truth. And one of the boys killed the other. So God's people have always had inconsistencies and problems. Accept it and work within the understanding that that is the way it is. And we do the best we can. We do the best we can with the circumstances we have, not moaning and griping about the way it could be and ought to be. We need to keep in mind the way it should be and then work with the way it is. But do something. Even if it's just to extend a hand to somebody that you would not normally relate to. Right? But don't just be a carping critic like Elimelech. And so it goes on and says, she knows what she's doing. She's not leaving her. She is staying with Naomi. What's Naomi? Naomi is a fragile little ecclesia. Right? Fragile little ecclesia. And she's not going to abandon her. Right? She's going with this little ecclesia that's doing what? It's reuniting with those that are in Bethlehem, Judah. And there's been a split between Naomi and her little ecclesia and the rest of them. And now the remnant of that ecclesia is coming back home to reunite with everybody. So they will be one. But there will be problems. And there will be difficulties and challenges along the way. And don't you ever think Ruth's life was easy. No matter how romantic and warm and lovely the story is, it wasn't an easy life. Ever. They go back home and it says, they went, they came to Bethlehem, Judah. When they come into the city, people come out and say, is this Naomi? She's changed so much. She's such a different looking person. She said unto them, don't call me Naomi anymore, but call me Bitterness. For the Almighty hath dealt very bitterly with me. I went out full, and the Lord hath brought me home again empty. Why then call ye me Naomi, seeing the Lord hath testified against me, and the Almighty hath afflicted me? She's not bitter against God. She's indicating that God has acknowledged her decision to leave was wrong, and that the right decision is for her to come back and to become one with the people that are there in the house of bread and praise. Not two separate groups, but one united group for the good of everyone. That the smaller group that has gotten smaller and smaller through attrition doesn't die completely. And so they join together with those that are in Bethlehem, Judah. And then it says, so Naomi returned, and Ruth the Moabitess, her daughter-in-law, with her, which returned out of the country of Moab, and they came to Bethlehem in the beginning of barley harvest.